This episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is brought to you by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 53, For the Sake of the Trust.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became a chronicler.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
And we trust that you are here with us once again to enjoy a little bit of Sherlockian discussion and revelry. We're very excited that we have an interview to share with you this time around. We'll get to that in just a moment. But, Bert,
yes,
how are you today? I neglected to say this is Scott Monty, I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
That's very helpful because that means I have to be Bert Wolder, and I get us confused sometimes. But yes, I'm well.
I know. But we are the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. And we've had some interesting discussion points over the last few episodes, whether it's Sherlockian Mythbusters or looking into some of the soap opera-like qualities that some of our our activities bring. It's a lot of fun either way.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun.
And I think, you know, what we're going to talk about this time around has to do with documented fun. Documented fun from throughout the history of the BSI.
Documented fun. You mean you can actually put fun down on paper? Incredible.
Well, if you sketch it out, you know, and diagram it, and, you know, you can figure it out. But we are recording today on June 6th, 2013.
Yes.
A very auspicious day, not because it's the anniversary of D-Day.
Oh, no, not because of that, but because it's the anniversary, it's the anniversary of B-Day.
B-Day?
Yes.
The invention. What could D-Day be?
Well, it's the invention of great sanitary appliances that are found in restrooms all across Europe. No, it's not that B-Day, not at all. It's the Baker Street Irregulars Day. It's this anniversary. That was a terrible joke. This anniversary, 79 years ago today, back on June 6, 1934, the very first meeting of the Baker Street Irregulars.
How about that? And who knew? Who knew that it would turn into, well, what has it turned into?
Well, it's turned into what I like to call, Robin, a force for good all across this world.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, if someone were to come up to you on the street, as so many do, and say,
would you please move over to the other side of the street?
Bert Wolder, will you stop accosting that young woman?
That's right.
No. If they said, Bert Wolder, how would you describe the BSI? What would you say to them? How would you describe it?
Well, I probably would default, you know, to the straight answer, which is it's a literary society devoted to the life, career, and cases of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first consulting detective. But it's more than that. I mean, to me, it's a community. When I think of it in one word, it's a community. It's people that I've known, like yourself, for a very long time. People I consider my friends, but You know, years ago, I went to one of my principal hobbies for most of my life was photography. And I used to have my own dark room and do a lot of black and white shooting. And years ago, I went to a meeting of a particular camera society that I'd been a long-standing member of. And there were a group of us actually up in Boston walking the streets. There must have been about 60 or 70 people. And we all had our cameras, and we would all go on walks, and we would all take pictures. And there was this wonderful moment when I realized that, unlike all the other times in my life, when people would say to me, "Daddy, please, it's enough with the photography. Please stop taking pictures." I was with people who were just taking pictures, and I felt very much at home. And so to me, the Baker Street Irregulars is feeling very much at home with people who share a common interest, with whom I have a common language, literary people who are interested in books and characters and authors and writing and storytelling. And that's what it means to me. What does it mean to you?
Well, it means people taking pictures. Well, no, I think what you've described there, and this is how I've described my first Sherlockian society meeting, which was at the Men on the Tor in Connecticut, as my first social network. Mm. You know, this was a group of people, as you say, that had a common interest, that's what binds us together. It's not necessarily what we have to talk about every time we're together, but we know we have that common interest. And to me, the BSI is that. It is, as you say, a literary society. It's also a publishing empire. You know, certainly in Edgar's time, having established the Baker Street Journal and any number of the publications that Edgar came out with, both personally and on behalf of the organization. But beyond that, it's become part of history, a minute part of history, if you will, but part of history nonetheless. And our guest, who's going to join us here in just a moment, I think is well poised to talk about that and to talk about what the role of the BSI and the BSI Trust moving forward is, and what the trust is and how it came about. So I think we have lots of things to talk about related to that.
Yeah, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that sounds like a great time for us to kind of segue into this little excerpt that you managed to pull together.
This piece of paper, which Brunton thought worth his while to consult, even at the risk of losing his job.
Well, it's nothing. It's nothing of any importance at all.
Nevertheless.
It's simply a copy of the singular old observance called the Musgrave Ritual, a ceremony peculiar to our family, which each Musgrave has to go through on his coming of age.
It's a strange catechism. Undated, but written in the style of the middle of the 17th century. Would you and Watson be good enough to read it out to me?
Oh, Doctor, I know it by heart.
Whose was it?
His who is gone.
Who shall have it?
He who will come.
Where was the sun?
Over the oak.
Where was the shadow?
Under the elm.
How was it stepped?
West 8x8, south 7x7, west 6x6, south 5x5, and 2x2, and so under.
What shall we give for it?
All that is ours.
Why should we give it?
For the sake of the trust.
And for the sake of the trust, we're honored to be joined by one Mr. Tom Francis, BSI.
Tom, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Good. Well, we're glad to have you.
Am I on the panel with Miss Meyerson and I forget who else is?
Bennett Cerf.
Good,
Bess Meyerson, Kitty Carlisle, and Steve Allen. That's exactly right.
The Chinless Wonder.
There we go. Well, as you know, you're part of the BSI Trust, but we'd like to have our listeners, we'd like to let our listeners in on that little secret, too. We referenced the Musgrave Ritual, where the notion of the trust was taken from, but in your words, You know, what is the trust? What does it stand for, and why is it even in existence?
The trust exists for a very simple reason, and that is to capture and preserve the history of the Baker Street Irregulars. One of our concerns was, and I'm like, I wasn't involved initially, but the concerns that came up were, you know, old Sherlockians were passing on, and their families thought they their correspondence and so forth had no value a lot of times, just paper that nobody cared about. We don't know how much was lost, and we're desperately trying to prevent any future losses and reach back for as much as we can so that everything in history about the organization can be preserved.
Yeah, well, I think it's a noble cause because, part of this is the correspondence between Edgar and Chris, for example, very intimate, very one-to-one, if you will. There wasn't a lot of flourish and, real publication about this. It's just that the great work resulted in the BSI coming to bear, the BSJ, et cetera. So it's great to know that there's some chronicling going on behind the scenes here. How much of, say, the material that John Lellenberg and some of the other editors have used for the history series are part of the archive?
I have no idea. Sorry, but I have no idea.
All right, wow, our first stumper. Okay.
Oh, no, wait a second. I think
you have to ask John Lellenberg.
No, wait a minute.
Well, just flip over all the cards.
We'll flip over all the cards. Ladies and gentlemen, meet Kirk Douglas. So, but Tom, how did it all get started? I mean, the idea, obviously, is, as you say, to preserve the history, the records, the paper,
like I
said,
I wasn't involved. I know, I'm sure Mike Whalen and Dan Pisnansky, at the very least, sitting around talking about this. I don't know who else was involved, but certainly Glenn Marenka fairly early on. And they were sitting around saying, you know, the same things I said to you a minute ago, and that's like, this stuff's getting lost. We got to do something to preserve it. It'd be nice if it was all in one place. So,
And
make it easy for historians and researchers and so forth. And so they then sat around chatting about it and decided to approach Harvard. And Harvard thought it was a great idea because they already have some interesting home stuff, you know, mostly the Bell collection, which the Spickle Band owns, you know.
So can you say a little bit about the Bell collection and about where it is at Harvard for those folks who are listening who aren't familiar with the whole story?
The Bell collection is not part of the trust. I just want to make that, you know, that already exists.
And who was Bell?
Harold Wilbington Bell. I always get his middle name wrong. He's one of the earliest Sherlockian scholars. He was a member of the Speckle Band, and he did astounding scholarship. He did the first dating of the stories in the canon and stuff like that. And he amassed a really nice collection of Holmes material. And when he passed on, somehow the band acquired it and then passed it on to the Houghton Library at Harvard. But it's still some strange arrangement where it still stays under the ownership of the band. The trust material that goes to Harvard becomes the property of Harvard. If Harvard wants to de-access anything that's in the trust collection, though, they have to give it back to the trust first. We get first off and take it back before anything would be disposed of.
And the trust itself is...
Let me just go back to Bell for an interesting thing.
Yeah, sure.
When Harvard decided to sponsor the 150th anniversary of Doyle's birth a couple of years ago, various things came out, and they thought something should be done about Bell. And one of the librarians, Peter Ricardo, who's also a member of the BSI, was somehow assigned or acquired responsibility for doing some research on Bell because very, very little was known. They didn't have any pictures of Bell. They had a couple of pieces of correspondence existed. Well, Peter has done such an astounding job that... he has enough material to publish a book on Bell. and the stuff he's found has been amazing.
Do you know if a book like that is actually in the works?
I believe it's not my place to say, but he and Dan Pozanski are seriously working on it. Yeah, he's got binders full of material and written material and then backup for it and so forth. Mm-hmm. I don't know where he stands on the project, but I think absolutely there's a book in the works in some way to say it. Mm-hmm. I don't know how far along he is.
And before, we get, any deeper into the whole question of the trust, the trust itself is a nonprofit organization, is it not?
It is. It's really a subset of the BSI.
And if folks are interested, they can find out more online because there's a website.
Yeah, we have a website.
BSITrust.org. We'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, BSITrust.org. That's right.
Every year at the time of the festivities in January, among other things, BSI members have an opportunity to contribute to the trust, but there's nothing special about January, any kind of donations.
The most of the contributions of money come in along with the applying for the dinner, on that form. But it's amazing, during the course of the year, stuff just seems to just come in. The material, which is what we really would like to get our hands on, more and more material, the material comes always when the newsletter goes out. Every time the newsletter goes out, there's a spike in material.
And talk a little bit about the kind of material you're looking for.
For the most part, we think of it focused principally on correspondence. We'd like correspondence from all the older regulars, well, the newer regulars, any regular. Occasionally, there's other papers and things that we'll take, and if it's appropriate, we don't see ourselves as getting everything Sherlockian. We don't see ourselves as capturing the history of all the science societies, or Peter doesn't like it when you say science societies. I forget he uses some other word, but other whole
Sherlockian group. Societies.
Sherlockian societies. That's it.
That's
not our place. There are plenty of other places to do that. And in fact, we as a general rule, don't even pick up the it's going to a library, and I always think library, I think books, and we don't make any effort to capture all the works of all our members over the years. We will we'll put a book in if there's maybe an annotation in it or something like that, or a single copy or a unique copy. We've got a few of those kinds of things. If somebody donates material like that to us, we make it plain that it may be auctioned off to support the trust.
Hmm.
And the money the trust gets, we do two things with it. We when we can't get a donation, and occasionally an interesting piece comes up, we will buy it. And then we use some of the money to support cataloging it faster than the library would ever catalog it. We send it with a lot of pre-cataloging. Bob Coghill pre-catalogs every bit of material before it goes to the library. But it's not their catalog, but it does provide resources. If somebody goes into a box of material or gets material, Bob's stuff is there to help steer them through it. But then the library does the cataloging, which goes online and so forth. They've got so much material, not just our material, but everything, that there's no priority on it. So we will fund up, which we did, almost everything they have except the last batch they've received has been cataloged, and people can, at least online, see what's there and so forth, and request them to send material if they can't make it to the library and all that kind of thing.
Now, to the extent that there are other materials that people have that are perhaps more in line with the Sherlock Holmes collection in Minnesota or the Arthur Conan Doyle collection in Toronto, what kind of a relationship does the BSI Trust have with either of those institutions, if any?
Well, we try not to step on their toes. We do like to get the get the BSI stuff. But if we have material that comes to us that that is more appropriate for them than us, we just forward it on to them. Now, the only thing we didn't forward to original stuff is I've gotten a few things that were like Shaw letters.
Okay.
We got some Shaw letters.
John Bennett Shaw. Yep.
Yeah, not George Bernard, right? The other one. And
or Artie.
You're Artie.
he wrote notes. He didn't write letters.
and the trust prefers to have original material. It's kind of like it's going to Harvard. We want original material. You know, we got that kind of an attitude there, and it's just what we would prefer. So we get, but Minnesota is happy just to be completist. So we've had a few Shaw letters have come in that have ended up for us. So I've just made a copy, and we send off to Minnesota the copy so that they can keep as complete a thing of Shaw as possible.
Yeah. Well, directly in Shaw's footsteps. Great. So you mentioned that you tend to get materials donated when the newsletter goes out. And the BSI Trust does have a newsletter that goes to, primarily members of the BSI, I would imagine previous donors to the Trust.
And the original mailing list was made up from the BSJ mailing list and the membership of the BSI.
Okay.
Which you would think would be all the same, but the BSJ list is much bigger than the membership of the BSI, obviously.
Of course.
And it somehow, I wasn't involved with the original setup, so I don't know, something's lost in time, but my biggest problem with the mailing list is, well, I have two problems with the mailing list. One is the newsletter is an expensive thing to produce.
Mm-hmm.
It generates results, so you don't want to not produce it. We would like it to become an email thing, if possible, if we could email the thing to people. So in the next newsletter, we're going to, I've got a few email addresses. I got 100 or so that we will send it out, but we'll still send the thing in the mail. We're going to ask people if they would like to get it in the in email format. You know, so send in your email address, and we'll take you off the postal list, and we'll email it. And if we can cut down on the printing, we could save some money and cut down on the postage. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and
both ways.
Looking at the website here in the newsletter section, it looks like every archived issue of the newsletter is available as a PDF directly from the website.
Right. And if you look at the later ones, you see the photographs are in color, which we can't do. That's another cost we don't do when we print it. We grayscale it when we print it. If we can get people to take the email version, they'll get the color pictures.
Sure. That's a lovely bow tie. Folks listening, you'll see what I'm talking about when you check out the link in the show notes.
Some of the material is, it's interesting to see if some of the materials, letters and so forth, to see, you know, the graphics that are on occasional things. It's tough sometimes to pick out decent graphics to out of the collection because so much of it is correspondence, you know?
Sure,
You wish you had cutesy stuff, so to make the newsletter more attractive is always an issue. But,
What's been the most remarkable piece of the archives that you've seen personally or that you've at least heard about as it's become cataloged?
There's so much great correspondence. One of my favorite things. It's not Sherlockian, but it tells a lot about our people. That's one of the things that's interesting about about Sherlockians, the members of the BSI. They are just interesting people anyway. And in an early batch of stuff that went over, there was a letter from Grant Wood to, I think, Smith. I can't remember now. Someone of our members, early members. You know who Grant Wood is? The paint artist who drew the American Gothic?
Oh, of course.
Okay.
It looks like he wrote a letter to William Hall, Bill Hall.
I can't remember who it was. Oh, maybe. Yeah. So So you know the story, or should I tell it anyway?
No, I've just got the archive pulled up on my screen here.
Okay. So some professor from Harvard had just completed a major work on Grant Wood. And the letter shows up, and in this letter, Grant Wood is discussing American Gothic before it's been shown.
Oh, my gosh.
And there's insights in there that was not in the guy's book. The guy had published the book, like, literally, you know, the day before, you know, the month before, very, very shortly, just published the book, and then this letter shows up at Harvard.
Wow. Well, you never know what you're going to get here.
The librarians, they you know, everybody's secretive today, you know. So the librarians can't discuss and tell you who's using the archive. It's confidential because they respect all, you know, all that business is today. I mean, you know,
of course,
they probably have to sign a HIPAA document or something.
Or they just let the president look into it for them.
Yeah, right.
Or the attorney general.
Just send it over through Verizon, you know.
Yeah.
But the thing is, what they have told me is that there's been, in the last year or so, there's been some activity, and they've also indicated that not all the people using it are just people researching BSI.
Hmm.
Because the material has interest beyond just BSI, so the material has actually been used by some scholars doing material beyond just doing history of BSI. So people looking at BSI material have been into it, I guess, too, quite a bit.
Interesting.
So it's already had quite a bit of activity.
Well, maybe executives from CBS are looking into it to actually figure out how to make Elementary a little more canonical.
Hopefully.
I don't know.
Oh, no, they have an answer. Just look in the canon, grab a name, and stick it on somebody.
It's worked so well so far. Yes, indeed.
We'll call the dog Milverton. We'll call the blackmailer Toby.
Oh, that we'll save that for another show.
Fine.
We'll have a healthy debate about that one.
What other questions do you have?
Well, It strikes me that we have an opportunity, Bert, you and I, because Tom mentioned about the newsletter going out. It looks like the newsletter goes out spring and fall, so twice a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's irregular.
Ish, yeah. and that's what actually brings in materials. And Bert, in as much as we've kind of positioned our show with our sponsor announcement before the show starts, like an NPR kind of arrangement, mm-hmm. We should have a pledge drive. You know, and we won't stop talking about the trust until people actually call in, which is going to be difficult since we don't do the show live.
And we're out of tote bags.
Yeah.
You can get a trust tote bag.
I want a trust. But to the extent that we can actually act as a mouthpiece for the trust, and, you know, this is part of why we're doing the show. We not only want to help people understand that the trust exists, what it exists for, but how we can help. So if folks are listening and you know... Go ahead.
One of the things that we want is for people to hang on to stuff. And you know, if you've got material, send it in. If you want to hang on to it until you die... You know, either make arrangements with your family or leave provisions in your will that at least your correspondence and things of that sort, things related to the BSI, get sent along.
Yeah.
You know, when we try to approach as many of the older time people as possible because, you know, like me, we're getting older and older, you know, and... going to get stuff before people pass on. You know, it's a kind of morbid sounding thing, but that's the fact. So we've actually contacted widows and so forth, and had good luck. There's been stuff around, and a lot of times they say, "Oh, geez, we threw all that stuff out." You know, oh my God, yeah. But we've had other people say, "Oh yeah, here's some stuff we were trying to get rid of it because nobody wants this." Well, yes, we do. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And some people have, it's unbelievable. Some will show up with Bob Caudill will get a box of material from somebody, and it's unbelievable. They've kept it, they've got it in folders by person, you know?
Wow.
You know, there's
some people are meticulous that way, right?
Yeah, and then the other times it's just like, yeah. But it's a treasure trove farm when he starts going through the stuff, you know?
Yeah.
You get all excited with what they find, you know?
Well, that's good. So if there's somebody listening who wants to do a cross-reference of an email database of all Sherlockians they know of with legacy.com, where all the obituaries are published, that would be a great way of staying on top of this. But no, this is, you know...
One of the side projects we're working on, it just says, is the oral history, which is a really...
I was going to ask you about that. Andy Solberg is involved with that, right?
Andy's done a... Andy's taken over, done a really good job. Don Terris was doing it before, and he did a fine job. And
so what's the oral history project? How does it intersect with the trust? How does it either depart from the trust or support the trust? What's the dividing line here?
Well, it's really under the auspices of the trust, because what happens is when we capture the interview with the person, it's put into the trust collection at Harvard. So the interview with the old Sherlockian is stored at the Houghton Library.
Hmm. And typically, what kind of insights or oral history are you looking for from these individuals? And are these just BSIs?
Everyone we've spoken to has been BSI at this point.
Okay.
And what we ask them is not just about the BSI, but we do ask them. We have a bunch of them. We ask them about their lives too. What was it like when you were growing up? Where did you go to school? What did you do for a living? Those kinds of things that we often don't know about people. And some of those stories turn out to be fascinating. Yeah, I'll give you a quick anecdote related to something I'm doing today. I'm reading one of Morrison's histories, Samuel Eliot Morrison, mm-hmm. one of his naval histories of World War II.
Go ahead.
And I love his writing. Okay, I've always said, "Well, is he this guy great?" Well, I did the interview with Dev DiGisaldi.
Mm.
And in the course of the interview, we're talking about stuff. He's talking about when he went to Harvard, and he had some issues, so he went to see his class advisor, who was Samuel Eliot Morrison.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and Morrison had heard that Dev had been in the Navy, and he gives him this big warm greeting, and then finds out he wasn't an officer. I'm pretty much just threw him out of his office. What a snob. That's the kind of weird little stuff that comes up. You know, these people are just, they just have great stories, and, you know, their lives are interesting there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when you're a Sherlockian, you know, some of us, we love Holmes, but every Sherlockian has a gazillion interests.
That's true.
You know, I mean, it was either Susan Rice or Mickey said to me one time, it's because we're readers, Tom. Mm-hmm.
It's true.
That's actually a great point. I forget where, I think I was listening to, I was listening to a podcast that Bert turned me on to. It's called Here's the Thing. Alec Baldwin hosts it.
Oh, yeah.
And he was interviewing Stacy Keach. And he was asking Stacy Keach about advice that he gives to some of the acting students that he trains. And he said, whatever you can do while you're still in college, major in something in the humanities or history, something that lets you read. Because, A, you're never going to have as much time on your hands to read ever again in your life. And, B, it broadens your world and your interests so much. And by being a reader, you become such a more well-informed citizen of the world and much more in touch with other interests. So that's exactly what Mickey was talking about, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, good example.
It's true.
So yeah. So the Oral History Project is really getting at some of those nuggets that you're not going to find in the documents that you wouldn't find as part of
it's not written any place, you know.
Yeah.
We ask them to reminisce about dinners they remember and anecdotes and stuff, and these things make, some of them make absolutely fascinating listening.
So what do you think the future holds for the trust in terms of what's happening in the world of the BSI today? You know, we do this show. We're now on our 53rd episode. Other than a website, this isn't really documented anywhere. It's a digital sound file.
You probably should make a copy of it and send it to the trust.
That's a good point. Well,
that's the thing. You know,
Bert, let's wait for the newsletter to come out, Bert, so we can be reminded of it.
Jerry Marglin once sent me a whole batch of material. I don't remember, like letters with Edgar Smith and on and on, you know, like, you mm-hmm. know, all the, and then he said, oh, you know, I have stuff with Andy Peck and others and so forth. And I said, well, send it along. He said, that is just, you know, it's just me and Andy. I said, we don't know who the Edgar Smiths of the future are.
That's true.
It could be us. You know, it could be you, you know. It could be anybody but Bert.
Good. Well, that narrows it slightly.
Well, yeah. Bert was telling me,
before you came on the show, Bert was telling me he's thinking of changing his name to Edgar W. Smith. It makes it easier.
Edgar W. Walder.
Edgar Walder Smith.
Well, the thing is, you don't know. And in the future, someone's going to say, you know, remember those two characters that used to do the podcast back when they had podcasts? You remember that? That was back before we put it on our eyeballs. And then they want to do the research, and, well, will there be a record of you? You know, well, there should be.
Only in post offices across the country.
No, I'm serious. We have no perspective on what goes on immediately around us. We might say, so-and-so, what a great Sherlockian he is, and you can identify. There are some people you probably don't have any problem saying, oh, yeah, people always want to know about that. But you don't know about all the peripheral people. And,
it's true.
You know?
Yeah, and
so the
other
idea is to preserve everything going. It's easier to preserve going forward.
Yeah. Now that we know that we need to, but
right.
I think
as long
Jerry's.
As we just keep reminding people. One of the problems you have going forward is there won't be as much correspondence.
Yeah, that's the concern here, right? Because everything is turning more electronic. Whether it's a sound file like this, which is easy enough to archive, but all of the emails that go into ether. You know, I mean, I have a folder in my email system where I, you know, keep all my BSI correspondence, and when I was running the BSJ as a business manager, all that stuff. But most of us don't think like that. It's disposable. It's there and it's gone. It's you know deleted and it's gone forever.
Well, the thing is though, because it's electronic, if somebody does like you did, that's those files could be saved.
Right. Right.
You know, in the future, that's where stuff will be anyway. At some point, we have talked to Houghton. What happened was this friggin' Chechnya people ruined our last meeting people were going. That was the day, you know, we were going to have a meeting where they're going to do a presentation to us, including talking about what they could make available digitally easily and for almost no money at all. There was some stuff like they were thinking all the early menus could be up.
Mm.
That was something they suggested. They can put the pictures up. You know, there's a bunch of things that can be done without a lot of work. They thought that the early, like a lot of early Smith correspondence, that's all in one place, get that up for people to be able to get online, you know, so. So we'll be getting to that fairly soon, too. Once we can get back together again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was unfortunate that got in the way, but that was something I was interested in talking to you about, because I can pull up the archive listings. You know, a bibliography essentially of everything that's in the archive.
Yeah.
Which goes from looks like roughly 1923 to 2007 at this point. But I can't click on a link and go see the letter from Grant Wood, for example.
No, you can't. But if there's a letter in there you want, they will, you know, the library would make a copy and send it to you for whatever whatever the fee they charge is. And I don't think it's too expensive, what I heard. But
sure.
But if you're a scholar that can't get to Cambridge, because you're in the other Cambridge or something, you can.
Right.
They would make it available to you.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
Yeah. Well, they got a great operation over there. Yeah. And it's nice to be in the company we're in over there too.
Yes. Yes. Well, I'm sure we can thank Dan for that. We'll have Dan on a future show, I think, to talk a little bit more about, say, the history of how the trust came about, his relationship.
Yeah, that was before my time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I don't have any direct knowledge of that.
Yeah. Well, this is great. Tom, is there anything that we haven't asked you about the trust that you think is relevant to share at this point?
We've covered why it exists, what it's trying to do, what kind of material we're generally looking for, and sort of we put out the begging for people to send stuff.
So subtle.
And you mentioned the website, which makes it easy to contact me or any of the trustees.
Mm-hmm.
You just click on my name or something in there, and I'll get an email, which is good. I do get occasional weird emails, from people who think I run the BSI.
Well, you're part of the shadow organization, aren't you?
Yeah. And then it's funny. I a couple of times, 3-4 times a year, I will hear from high school and college kids
Help with their term papers.
Yeah, I actually got an interesting thing from. Two girls from California, high school kids from California. They had a whole bunch of inquiries, but they actually turned out to be as much Doyle. It was Holmes with some interesting Doyle stuff. And I answered all their little questions, gave them some information, sent them stuff, and then they sent me a copy of their final paper. The damn thing could be published in the journal. It was that good. Nice to see.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Well, this has been great. Tom, I want you to know you've made I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere history because I think this is the first time, I can say almost definitively, that this is the first time that the phrase, those friggin' Chechnyans, was used on our podcast. So, that's pretty cool. So that'll go in the archives. Yeah. That'll be in the trust. Yeah. You made history. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Tom, thanks for taking the time to discuss the trust with us, and we trust that you will continue to see the archives grow, and we hope we can be of assistance as we continue to move.
Well, all kidding aside, don't forget now you really have to do something about making sure your podcast gets into the trust.
Well, you put us on the hook, so we will do that.
And I don't know what else, that's the opening. We have when the trustees sit around and talk, we sit around regularly thinking, what are the things we haven't remembered? What are the things we haven't thought of? And this is the kind of thing that, oh, geez, another thing we didn't think about,
Yeah.
We don't want stuff to get lost.
Absolutely.
Don't want stuff to get lost.
Good.
So keep begging.
We will keep begging in every format that allows.
Yes.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Well, it's, I haven't talked to Tom in a long time. I spoke to him at the BSI weekend, but used to see him all the time when I lived in the Boston area, and really have some great memories of carpooling from Boston to New York for the BSI weekend with Tom. And then later on, we added Richard Olkin to the mix, and it was just, to me, that was part of the highlight of my New York sojourn. Yeah. It was the experience with my fellow Sherlockians.
Yep.
And we were just getting Tom warmed up by the end of the interview there, but he's a delight. He's absolutely delightful to speak with.
He is a delight. And it's also delightful to have sponsors, so this seems like a good time to mention that this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is brought to you by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. And Scott, what can we find in the wonderful world of the Wessex Press these days?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, we sing their praises all the time. But, you know, one book that I've been spending a little more time with recently is The Strand Magazine and Sherlock Holmes by Robert Veld.
Oh, isn't that great?
It really is. It describes the history of how Conan Doyle, well, how the magazine came to be in the first place and how the association between Doyle and Greenough Smith came about. And I know Bob Veld was working on it for quite some time. Bob's from Australia, and I know his personal life suffered as he was trying to crank this book out, and his family is forever grateful that he has completed it. But it really stands as a testament. It actually appeared, I don't know if a lot of people realize this, it actually appeared like The Strand. It appeared in serial format in the Sydney Passengers Passengers Log. That's their society publication. So effectively, chapters appeared in serial form in their newsletter. Yep. And Bob finally decided, you know what, I'm going to pull this all together. I'm going to make a book out of it. And the fine folks at Wessex Press actually made it happen for him.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful reminder of how groundbreaking Conan Doyle's insight was about narrative, as well as how popular it was and how much it contributed to the birth of the Strand magazine. Because up until that time, the notion of a single character running through a series of repeating short stories that were complete in and of themselves was somewhat new. The custom was to serialize chapters of a novel, but these were individual stories that stood alone, issue after issue, with a single character running through them. And Conan Doyle believed he was the first to realize this, and the Strand magazine was the first to put it into practice. So if you are interested at all in that development in publishing history, and the publisher, the editors, the illustrators, as Peter Blau has observed, it's a grand story and told well indeed, and available from Gasogene Books, an imprint of the Wessex Press.
Indeed. Find them online at wessexpress.com. And of course, our other sponsor, the Baker Street Journal, which you can find at bakerstreetjournal.com, of course, publishes the already named Baker Street Journal, as you would imagine, but it is also the publishing arm of the BSI. And if you look on the site there, under items for sale, there's a section called Deal Table, and there is a special half-price sale going on right now on To Keep the Memory Green, which is a series of essays of colleagues honoring the memory of the late and great Sherlockian and Holmesian Richard Lancelin Green, a legendary figure. It's edited by Stephen Rothman and Nick Utekin, who are respectively associated with the BSJ and the Sherlock Holmes Society of London. So that and much, much more available on bakerstreetjournal.com.
Hear, hear.
Well, what if people want to get in touch with us for any ungodly reason?
My God.
Can you imagine?
Battery-powered Ouija boards, I think, are the only way. Isn't that right? There can't be any other.
No, wait, those are battery-powered now?
Yeah.
I have to trade in my manual.
This is the 21st century, buddy.
I guess so. I'll download the app.
You know, I bet there is a Ouija board app.
There probably is. Well, that means if you're electronically connected or within the sound of our voices, you can reach us in a number of ways. We'd certainly welcome comments on ihearofsherlock.com or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/ihearofsherlock.
Yeah, you can contact us any way at all. If it's Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter, it's all I Hear of Sherlock. So it's facebook.com/ihearofsherlock, ihearofsherlock.tumblr.com, and twitter.com/ihearofsherlock. And leave us a review, please, on iTunes.
Mm.
And you can just get that easily at bit.ly/ihearofsherlock. It'll take you right there. Or call us, and leave us a comment on our comment line. Call 774-221-READ. That's in the United States, so that's +1-774-221-READ or 774-221-7323.
You know, it's been a long time since we've gotten an audio comment, Bert. We've gotten lots of comments in writing, which is great. But it might be interesting to hear some of the voices of some of our listeners as well. So if you are within reach of a phone, that's a pretty easy way to go about doing it. And we'd love to take that audio comment, splice it into the show, and debate it together. We've also got a thriving Sherlock Holmes community on Google+. I know a lot of people are just becoming familiar with Google+, what it is and what it does, etc. But the good news is that it's growing. We are at over 745 members at this point. You can find that. Again, we'll put a link to the community there in our show notes, but it's bit.ly/SH community, capital S, capital H, capital C, for SH community.
Is that good?
Well, if you're within earshot of that sound, that means it must be time to get gassy. But in this instance, we do not have an editor's gas lamp for you. We do have, however, the chair with us still from the BSI Trust, Mr. Tom Francis. Now, in every newsletter that goes out from the Trust, which, by the way, the newsletter is called For the Sake of the Trust, Tom has a column in there called From the Chair. And we thought that rather than doing a gas lamp, since we had Tom with us, we would ask him to read his From the Chair. And in this case, Tom's going to read from the fall 2011 issue of the newsletter For the Sake of the Trust. Tom.
I'm a collector. When I was young, I found and fell in love with the stories of Sherlock Holmes. When I was about 20 years old, and being somewhat back in the antediluvian era, I was thrilled to discover that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle had written other things. I figured that since the Sherlock Holmes stories were so good, but finite in number, I could go on to read the other things that Conan Doyle wrote in order to continue the enjoyment provided by the Holmes saga. This started me on a quest. My goal seemed simple: find one copy of every book written by Arthur Conan Doyle. I wasn't fussy. I just wanted to get books to read. Slowly, over the years, I found the books, old copies, reprints, collected editions, some hardbound, some in paper. As time went by, I began to fall into the trap of trading up. Sure, I already had a copy of The Doings of Raffles Haw, but at some point I'm standing in a bookstore with an English first edition in my hand. I have to buy it. Later, I find a pirated edition that has the first ever book publications of The Red-Headed League and The Bascom Valley Mystery. On another occasion, I find a copy in a dust jacket. I wanted one copy of each of Conan Doyle's books, and now I've managed to acquire four copies of just this one title. Repeat the above with all sorts of variants from, here's a copy of The Hound of the Baskervilles I've never seen to, I can't let this lost world sit here just for $2, throw in gifts from family and friends. Now my library is about 4,000 volumes, half of which are Sherlockiana and Doyle. My Holmes collecting extends beyond books. I have recordings, dolls, toys, pictures, tchotchkes of all sorts, scrapbooks full of ads, clippings, cards, and newspaper articles. This stuff seems to never end. I'm not as bad as, say, John Bennett Shaw, whose extensive collection is now at the University of Minnesota, who once remarked to me that he was negotiating to have his collection preserved. You should have seen their faces when I told them they would need refrigerators for my chocolate pieces. Today I'm chairman of the Baker Street Irregulars Trust. We're preserving the history of the Baker Street Irregulars. The Houghton Library at Harvard University is the repository of the collection. What the Trust is seeking are documents which tell the story of the Baker Street Irregulars and of its members. We also intend to preserve key artifacts from the Society's past and its membership. We generally do not put books into the collection. Most books, including the many written by members of the Baker Street Irregulars, are properly housed with book collections, so unless the book is about the Irregulars, bears a unique BSI aspect, such as a telling inscription, or perhaps is the copy of a noted Irregular, it would not become part of the collection. If books are donated and don't fit in with the collection, they may be sold to raise funds to help preserve and expand the archives. The point of all this is, despite the amount of material that I've acquired, my personal correspondence is minimal, and I've managed to collect no historical material. This is a sad and almost a failing on my part, as in my present position, I feel a sense of guilt for being unable to make a significant material donation to the Baker Street Irregulars Trust Archives. Recently, a friend and I were discussing how cleverly Jonathan Swift had satirized the way people interpret scripture to suit their own ends. In A Tale of a Tub, I recall that Conan Doyle had a very clever poem that covered the same subject from his Songs of Action, a parable. The cheese mites asked how the cheese got there and warmly debated the matter. The Orthodox said that it came in from the air, and the heretic said from the platter. They argued it long and they argued it strong, and I hear they're arguing now. But of all the choice spirits who lived in the cheese, not one of them thought of a cow. I have three copies of Songs of Action, two English and one American. I pick one of the English volumes up just to have a copy of the poem. And when I opened it up, I found I had Edgar W. Smith's copy, complete with his book plate. This is a nice second-class relic that I'll be donating to the Trust Archives.
Well, I always like it when we have a guest reader like that, when we can take advantage of... I just realized this. I wanted to ask Tom about one other thing with regard to the BSI Trust. Mm-hmm. And that is if they would accept a powder blue blazer. That's an inside joke for those of you who are not familiar. But let's just say if you're familiar with the Smithsonian Institution...
That's right.
At one point, they accepted the news blazer that Ted Baxter, a.k.a. Ted Knight, wore on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which was, at its time, a very culturally significant television show. And they put Ted's news jacket in the Smithsonian, along with Fonzie's leather jacket and Edith and Archie Bunker's chairs and Kermit the Frog and the like. Mm-hmm. But Peter Blau... who is notorious for wearing a powder blue blazer, we may find his Sherlockian garb in the Trust archives at some point in the future.
I hope so. Well, you know, Jeremy Bentham, the great, 18th century philosopher, is renowned for, upon his passing, had himself stuffed. His order was, his wishes were that he be stuffed and kept at the university, and preserved in a cabinet. And I can't remember what the... I should look this up. So I will look...
Thump, 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 thump.
Thump, thump, thump on... Yes, Jeremy Bentham, British philosopher, 1748 to 1832. And there he is. It's called the Auto Icon. You can find him on Wikipedia. He died on the 6th June, 1832, and made careful preparations for his body's preservation as an auto icon. It was acquired by University College London in 1850, normally kept on public display at the end of the South Cloisters in the main building of the college. For the 100th and 150th anniversary of the college, it was brought to the meeting of the college council, where Bentham was listed as present but not voting.
So this, I should hope not.
So this is by way of saying that there's a precedent here, and so Sherlockians themselves might even be preserved at the Houghton.
Oh, it's like one of my favorite Mike Peters cartoons, the political cartoonist Mike Peters. Mm. It was a split screen. On the left side was a picture of this wild-haired gentleman behind a piano with a pen in hand. It said Beethoven composing. And then the next frame was just a pine box and a couple of people looking into it saying, ew, and it said Beethoven decomposing.
Yes. Oh, dear. Too many notes, Mozart.
Yes. Oh, well, I think we've done it again, Magoo.
Plenty of it, actually. Maybe too much.
I don't know how that happened.
I don't know either.
Well, feel free to be in touch with us, as we've said. If you have suggestions for future shows, we would certainly love to hear that. If you have feedback about the existing show, if it's good, we'd love to hear it. But no, we'd love to hear it either way. This format thrives on the back and forth and knowing that we're doing things that you like as well. So we thank you for your continued listenership and look forward to bringing you more.
Yes, we do. And that leaves me to state the obvious, which is that I'm Bert Wolder.
And I guess that means I'm Scott Monty. And together we say,
The game's afoot.
Afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I am neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck. And believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.